Coming up next on Triangulation, I sit down with Dan Lyons, author of Lab Rats, to talk about how Silicon Valley is changing work for the worse. All that coming up next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 372, recorded Friday, November 9th, 2018. Dan Lyons, Lab Rats. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with people who are writing amazing things about technology. And I love doing the show. I'm Jason Howell. I love it when it's my opportunity to do this because, like, I do a lot of reading in my spare time. But when I have an interview on deck for Triangulation, I'm sometimes given books that maybe I wouldn't have pulled off the shelf, but then I become totally and completely enraptured by them, which is absolutely the case with today's interview. Joining me today is Dan Lyons, former tech editor for Newsweek. You've done so many things. Former staff writer for HBO's Silicon Valley, author of many books, including Disrupted in 2016. That was all about your time at HubSpot. And then now, the book that just came out, I guess was it the end of last month, so within the last couple of weeks on October 23rd, Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. It's an enlightening tale of glee and happiness, right?
Somebody tweeted at me this week saying, you know, I like the book, but boy, it's so painful to read. I just think a lot of people aren't going to read it out here because, you know, it's just... Yeah, it'd be too stressful. I thought, well, that was really smart marketing on my part. You know, like that was a really good way to go at a book. Just make one that's so unhappy that, yeah, people won't read it. That was I should have thought that through a little better.
That's okay. You know? Hey, the world was turned upside down a couple of years ago. Normal became abnormal. We weren't really quite sure if people are going to want to dive deeper into the mayhem of the world or seek relief. Thankfully, your book kind of does both, right? Like, you spend 2/3 of the book really focused on how much things are screwed up. And then you spend the last 1/3 of the book focused on companies that are doing it right, the improvements that are being made.
Yeah, and it's sort of a radical idea now that here's a crazy innovation. You could just, you know, treat your employees really, really well, and they'll do good work. And that's the last part. And those were my favorite people to talk to. They're amazing people out in tech right now who are, and I couldn't even get to all of them in the book, but it really does leave you kind of. I mean, I hope, because I was left after doing the reporting feeling really good about where things are going. But before you get to that, you have to sort of explain, well, how have we gone astray?
Yeah, how have we gone astray? And I think that's probably my top of the show question is, just in a general sense, why does work make people so unhappy? And I mean, and I don't know if this is a current thing or if this has just always been the way it is, because I've, you know, throughout the course of my life, I've become very accustomed to people when they talk about work, when they talk about their job, always kind of referring to it in the, I gotta go to work today. You know, it's never like, I get to go to work. So maybe we've always just been unhappy with our job, but maybe we're unhappy in new ways now. What do you think?
Yeah, that's, I think, is the thing, that we're unhappy in a new way. That's exactly it. That the unhappiness you hear about now is psychological, and it's lasting, and it's really deep. I mean, it's different than the I gotta go to work, or take this job and shove it, that kind of thing. You hear now, what happened to me is after Disrupted came out, I was overwhelmed with email from people telling me their stories, and they often talked about these bad jobs, and they really, you could tell it was very cathartic for them to tell me their whole story. And then they would often talk about escape, like, I'm so glad I escaped from that place. Whether they were fired or quit didn't really matter, but they sounded like people who had been in a cult and had managed to sneak out when the guards weren't looking, you know, and or they talked about the way people who have been in like a crazy psychology experiment might be after they got out of it. Like, boy, that really messed me up. People would talk about being, you know, messed up sometimes years after the job ended, and really, really sort of traumatized. So that I thought was new and interesting. I thought that was you know, we most of us don't do physical work anymore, so we're not lifting, you know, mm-hmm. big heavy things all day. We're not exhausted maybe physically, but we're often psychologically stressed out. You see, yeah. So that was essentially what I was looking at and trying to write about.
And meanwhile, you know, some of these people who are saying, man, I'm really happy that I escaped that job. What do they escape to? And 2 years later, would they be in the same position? Because it really seems like we've become so accustomed, especially here in Silicon Valley, but in many industries, tech particularly, of this kind of like 2 to 3 year jump cycle. It's like, yeah, I spent 2 years here. And then the only way for me to really propel myself upward and move upward is to move on to a new position, and that's just kind of become the way it is.
Yeah, or you move laterally. So I interviewed a young couple who are in New York who got out of college, finished university, and then wanted to go work in startups, and they kept taking these jobs thinking, oh, this is cool. I'll go in with a, you know, sort of entry-level thing, but it'll move up. And then they found out that they were essentially just telemarketers. They're just stuck in these big boiler rooms. They weren't getting paid very much. And there was no advancement. You were just expected to sit in that room, hit your numbers if you could, and then kind of burn out and churn out. And then they would take another one and find out it's the same job in a different place. Mm-hmm. And they had become really, it was shocking and kind of upsetting to me, because to me, they were very young. I don't think they were even 30 yet. And they were already, they had gone through this a few times, already were sort of burnt out and as cynical as, say, I am at 58. But they just sort of felt like hopeless, that there was no alternative. No one was going to hire them and then let them do something for a year or two and then see their talent and give them a chance to get a promotion and move up to something better. And I think they were both going to just give up and go travel the world for 6 months or something. And they were, it was like a lost generation. Some of the people in the late 20s that I talked to who had been in the workforce only for 5 or 6 years, but really had a feeling of kind of hopelessness about their careers, which actually made me really sad. It was, you know, because these were very talented, smart, skilled people who had studied a lot of different things in college and then got out and just were sitting in a boiler room reading a sales script, you know. So it was,
Well, and so young as well, so much time to look forward to, yet to feel that kind of locked in, you know, locked in a cage sort of feeling at such an early stage. I don't think that's age as much as just the environment around which they've been surrounded by, the work environment. Do you think that Silicon Valley largely at this point is responsible for a lot of other industries' bad work environments? Like, is this trickling out and beyond Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I think an interesting thing that's happened in the last, say, 10 years is that Silicon Valley was always just a place that exported chips and software and routers and computers, and they still sell that. But I think almost the biggest export from Silicon Valley in terms of impact in the last 10 years has become business models or you know, ways of running a business. That's now a big part of how people outside Silicon Valley view it. Is like, well, those guys were all growing really fast. They must be doing something special. So you see companies like Walmart and Target and Ford and countless others sort of setting up labs, research labs or incubators in the Valley. Like, they physically want to be in that geographic location, I think almost to sort of absorb something of the culture of the way businesses are run there and then use that as a transfusion and bring that, those people that they have in the Valley will sort of bring that culture of innovation back into the mothership, wherever that may be in the Midwest. And you see things like Agile, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and Lean, which are essentially grew out of the computer industry, the tech industry, now being adopted everywhere. You see companies like IBM, which I realize IBM is a tech company, but kind of not really. And you see IBM talking about wanting to be like a startup. You know, we're gonna be big, but we're gonna be nimble like a startup. Or GE, Immelt used to talk about, you know, we need to become a tech company. It's not enough to just use tech. We need to be a tech company. And so he embraced Lean Startup. You see this sort of envy of Silicon Valley from other industries, and then these attempts to kind of mimic what they think people are doing in the tech industry.
Yeah, this like reinvention of management, essentially, and saying, oh, well, for whatever reason, we feel now is the time to pull the rug out and change things up. And who knows why that is. Maybe part of that is because the shift into the digital age kind of implies that things don't run by the same rule book anymore. So there needs to be a better way. But I mean, is it actually better? I've heard of Agile. I hadn't really heard very much of Lean Startup prior to reading the book. But maybe take a few minutes to kind of explain what supposedly makes Agile and Lean Startup so different from kind of your standard kind of management practice.
Yeah, that's a great question. I can explain both of them in a nutshell. But essentially, yeah. Both are almost new religions. And Agile is much bigger than Lean. I think Lean is still, you know, Eric Ries wrote a book called The Lean Startup, and it became this runaway bestseller. And then it became a sort of a religion and a kind of practice. And Eric and other people take that into big companies and do these big consulting engagements, teaching people the principles of Lean Startup. That's fine. Agile is a kind of a different animal because it didn't begin with one guy in his book. It began in 1999 with a bunch of software engineers, but very eminent software engineers. 17 of them went on a retreat to Snowbird, the ski resort in Utah. And they were faced with a problem, which was software development has become cumbersome and slow and inefficient, and it's just not working. Like the way we develop software is kind of broken, and people were using a methodology called waterfall, where you a project management methodology, and it wasn't working. And they came up with this idea of agile software development, and I think they meant agile like with a lowercase a. Just we'll work in sprints, we'll do little bits, we'll be in touch with the business user inside our company. We're not just going to go off for 3 years and write this big monstrous piece of code and then just drop it on their doorstep. We're going to be, you know, going back and forth and interacting. But essentially, it was just a way to write software faster. And somehow it morphed into this thing where people said, you can use those same principles for anything, not just writing software. You can have agile lawyers and agile marketers and agile bloggers and agile, you know, everything. And then it morphed up another level and became almost like this magical elixir that can transform an entire organization. So it's not just about doing discrete tasks in a new way, or not just a new way to do project management, but almost a new overarching philosophy or religion for how to think of the organization as a whole. The guys who created the Agile Manifesto in 1999 didn't intend any of that, right? They didn't imagine any of that. I think they say we sort of could imagine it could be applied to other things, but it wasn't what they were trying to do. And they didn't really have any rules. They had 12 principles that were very sort of general principles, sort of it's better to work in small chunks than big chunks or whatever. There's sort of things like that. So they look at what Agile has become, and even they are scratching their heads and saying, one guy's quote to me was like, look, 90% of what they call Agile now is just bullshit. It's just utter bullshit. And along the way, there are, you know, thousands of books have been written about Agile, and now there are Agile gurus who were never software developers, weren't any of the original manifesto creators. They're just people who came along and realized they could make a business out of selling Agile. Big consulting firms now go in and sell these giant Agile engagements, and then most of them fail. So the other weird thing about Agile is the vast majority of Agile implementations utterly fail to produce any improvement. And so it's like, it would be like hiring a personal trainer who says, I have all these wacky new ways for you to lift weights and work out and what diet to eat. Now, I got to tell you, 9 out of 10 of my clients see no improvement, and many actually are worse. They get fatter, or they get weaker, or they get injured. But I think you should do this. And then when you go through 6 months of this and you've thrown out your knee, another personal trainer comes along and says, you know, that guy was doing Agile all wrong. Agile works. It's just the way he did Agile doesn't work. So it becomes this endless loop of hell. You just keep going through Agile implementations, new forms of it. And some of them, you know, are really, really kludgy, to the point that organizations, especially big companies, will have now a new department in the company called the Agile Department. And it's full of people who train, you know, employees in how to use Agile. There's actually an Agile career path where you can move up. There are things like you work in a scrum, which is essentially just a word for a group, and you have a scrum master. And then you have so many scrums and so many scrum masters that they have to coordinate. So they have their scrum masters all report up to, I forget the title, but some other level. And that guy will have, you know, 6 scrum masters who he maintains. And then, you know, for each 6 scrum masters, you have to have another person. So you just keep adding people. And then in each one of your stand-up meetings, in order to let the other scrum know what you did, you send one person over as your scrum ambassador, and they have a scrum of scrums. You know, they have like a meta meeting about the meetings, you know. And so it's like you want to make your car go faster, so you just hook 2 other cars to both sides full of like car speeder uppers, you know, and like, and that's going to make you go faster. So it ends up being the antithesis of what it promises to be. And it's kind of crazy making for people who go through the training, because you really have to relearn entirely how to do your job, and for no real reason. So yeah, it's a crazy thing. I think what's really going on is, to talk about a point you made a minute ago, was that there is a sense that now there's the internet, we're in the digital age, and the way we ran companies for the last 100 years doesn't work anymore. And that's kind of true. And the way people work isn't the same anymore. And that's true. So there's a sense that we need something new, but nobody quite knows what that is yet. And we're in a kind of an experimental age, and it's also driven by fear, because some of these companies have seen other companies or entire industries go out of business. I worked at one, in a Newsweek, which now exists, but it's a different company, and it's the brand, but not the company, but Blockbuster and Borders Books. So, you know, whole industries have collapsed. The retail apocalypse is taking place. So people are terrified. People running companies are terrified. And that fear gets pushed down through the organization. And if you're the CEO of one of these companies, you have to show your board or the world or both that, like, you know, we're changing, we're adapting, we're going to avoid disruption, we're going to embrace the disruption. So they are grabbing at anything they can get, and it's inevitably, this is going to be a chaotic period, right, in corporate history. I do think it will settle into something more stable, but for now, those of us who are in the workforce are living with this chaos, and it is having some effects on people psychologically.
And I think that's the key behind your book in general, is the psychological impact of the instability of the workplace nowadays. And mm-hmm. you know, a key component of that, of course, lies in the technology. Of course, a lot of what you talk about, and a lot of, you know, stuff happening in Silicon Valley revolves around technology. These are technology companies that place high value, high importance into the power of what technology can do. So then everything becomes hyper techified, if that's a word. And at that point, you end up dealing as employees more with robots than you do with humans. Mm-hmm. That makes you feel dehumanized, which you point out is one of the key points of why people are so dang miserable. And it's just a snake eating its own tail at that point. You also open things up in the book, and I thought this was really interesting because I'd never heard of this before, with the Lego Serious Play as kind of an example of how kind of modern management theories are being, you know, thrown around and tried in new different ways. It's like, well, why don't we take this, you know, these blocks of Legos and see how an employee can interpret them in a different way? And this is going to teach that employee something about themselves. It'll teach us something about our employee. When at the end of the day, is it just all baloney? Or I don't know. It's hard to know.
Yeah,
I don't know if there's any there.
Right. I'm mostly glad that you said you had never heard of Lego Serious Play, because neither had I. And then as I was writing it, I thought, what if I'm like the only one who doesn't know about this and everybody knows about this? I mean, as I was working on the book, I would talk to friends of mine and work in different industries, and nobody had heard about it. So I thought, okay, good. This really is sort of news to most people. Yeah. And most people's reaction, I think, is like yours, like, and mine, which was, wow, this seems really kooky. And yeah, it actually has been around for, you know, a little bit of a while, 10, 15 years. But in the last, say, 5 years, it's really taken off because agile trainers started using Lego workshops as part of their agile engagements. And so as agile took off, and became this, you know, really pervasive thing, Legos went along for the ride. But essentially, there were some people close to the Lego company who came up with this idea that you could use Legos to as a teaching tool, that it wasn't just a game thing. You could do, and they created this methodology called Lego Serious Play, and it actually has a trademark. Like, you have to write it with the little things in parens, the TM, and it's, you know, it's capital L, S, and P, and they're very serious about this. And there's all this sort of quasi science where there are papers about how this works by doing this, that, and the other thing to your brain, and it stimulates this part of your brain, and none of it's really, you know, proved, but it sounds good. And yeah, and they go in, and so for $3,000 or $5,000, you and I could go take a weekend workshop and become certified Lego trainers. And then we can go out and take our certification and sell engagements to companies. I also think it's hilarious that you and I can't just go buy some Legos and start doing this. You need to be like certified, as if it's like you're a doctor or something. You know, you're an official Lego trainer. So there's an entire industry built just around training new Lego trainers, right? Like, that's a business. There are companies that just do that. They have big conferences and conventions, and there are like thousands and thousands of Lego trainers around the world. If you just do a Google search, it'll have like, you just go down a rabbit hole and you find this. It's such a big business that it's had a schism, and there's two camps, like the original Lego people and the new Lego people, and both think the other one is wrong. And, yeah, and essentially you sit down and you do a bunch of exercises. Like, one is think of a problem that you have at work that's really, you can't solve, or think of something you really don't like about work. Now build that out of Legos. So, you know, without being, you don't have to be literal. You just make a, you know, you build whatever you want, and then it gets people talking. So there is this idea that very introverted software engineers who tend to be kind of shy and keep to themselves, it forces them to get out and start talking about stuff and externalizing it and talking about their work process. So that in turn, if you do that in a group, gets everybody kind of talking about, well, I like to write software this way, you like to do it this way. And so, you know, maybe it opens up. And there's one called Make a Duck, which I write about in the book, where I met with a Lego trainer for a half a day and did some of these exercises, and like, she sort of ran through, like, if you were my not patient, but, you know, if you were working at a company that was doing this, this is one we would do called Make a Duck. It's the most famous Lego Serious Play workshop. You get six pieces. It's always the same six pieces, and say, make a duck. You got 30 seconds, go. And so, yeah, I opened the book with me sitting in a coffee shop in Menlo Park doing this, and hilarity ensues, you know, as I sit there trying to make a duck. So, yeah, I don't think it's evil. Like, I don't think anybody's setting out to, you know, let's ruin people's lives. I just think it's, you know, maybe pointless. And I actually think for some people it could really be stressful. I think for me it was stressful even in the coffee shop. But if I was thinking like, God, my job hinged on this and I'm, you know, 50 something years old and I know they want to fire me, they're, you know, guys my age, we have targets on our back and now we got to play with toys. And if I don't play with the toys right, I might lose my job. So I think for some people it could be stressful. Also, I just think it's weird to be in an encounter group with people that you work with. I think that's awkward and weird, and it's you're kind of peeking into your brains and having this sort of, I think I'd say it's like an EST workshop with the added indignity of toys. You know, I don't know. I think it's there's a lot of silliness that has come about as people go fetching around looking for answers to the question of how should we work. The Lego thing is one of my favorites. Yeah.
I think a large part of what you're touching on right now is the psychological pressure that seems to be applied to modern workers now, right? Like we are something to be tested, to squeeze out maximum productivity out of. And if that involves diving into our brains in ways that even we don't understand, well, hey, you know, it helps the bottom line. So it makes sense. You mentioned in the opening pages about these kind of tormenting workplace environments. Somebody's told that nobody likes them on their first day. And instead of that person saying that's weird, they decide to stick around because they think that it might be a brain challenge. And that's really messed up.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite stories. It was a guy I met at a conference. And, you know, because when you write a book like Disrupted, like everybody wants to tell you their story about the kooky boss, you know. So I got a lot of these. But yeah, and he said, he got hired for this job. And first day, his manager or supervisor or whatever, you know, called him to a meeting and said, I just want you to know, I don't like you. And nobody else in the department likes you. In fact, when they asked us what we thought, we all said, no, don't hire him. But we got overruled by the CMO or whatever. So you're here. But I just want you to know you're starting out already in a deep hole. And you're going to have to really, you know, dig yourself out of that and earn people's trust, right? And this guy's like, why are you telling me this, like, on the first day? And I guess he thought, like, yeah, is this woman – maybe if she's trying to manipulate me, which would be, you know, kind of clever. You could play this game and say, I'm afraid this person's going to come in and slack. Oh, you know what she said? Everybody thinks you're arrogant. And as he was, he had some experience. He had had a couple of jobs in this field. And I guess maybe he gave off this vibe that, look, I already know more than you guys do about this. And I don't think he was like that, but that's how they perceived him. And so they wanted to, like, knock him down a peg by saying, you know, you came in, everybody thought you were kind of full of yourself, kind of arrogant, and you're going to need to really, you know, be humble and, you know, learn from these guys. And yeah, it was just that was a good one. There was another one where someone was in a place for 4 years and she wouldn't leave, even though she knew they hated her. She and her boss were locked in this sort of like Stockholm syndrome thing where he would torment her. And she kept trying to earn his praise or you know, saying, if I just work hard enough, eventually I'll win them over and they'll like me. And one of the things this guy did was have everybody come in a room and stand sort of, you know, back to front in a circle and then write one word or a phrase about the person in front of them and tape it to their back.
Right. Oh my
God. And then all go around and say the word that you read and then talk about that person whose back is to you. You're right in front of you and say all this bad stuff about them in front of the group. And the victim of this, the target, really can't say anything. He just has to sit there and go through it. And they somehow thought this was like good. It was going to help people because it was going to be a way for people to be honest with each other about really what they really thought of each other. So yeah, we get these crazy stories. And that woman even now says, I really don't understand why I stayed. Like it's weird. And she has such PTSD now. She's in San Francisco, or actually she's in the East Bay. The company's in San Francisco. And if she goes into the city, she will plan her route so she doesn't have to go through the particular street in South of Market where their office is. Like, she doesn't want to drive past the building because it will, you know, freak her out a little bit. And she's not – this woman is not a little snowflake. She is a tough woman, and it's just – it really – it wounded her self-esteem. It really, really left her psychologically messed up. She's another one who read my book and then wrote to me like, oh my God, it was like reliving my nightmare when I read about your nightmare. And yeah, there was, I mean, great stories. I mean, fantastic story. I mean, they're not fantastic. Right. They're horrible.
Depressing.
Right? But, I
mean,
but as a journalist, right. I'm sitting there going like, oh my God, this stuff there's is like gold. Here. It's gold, Jerry. Yeah. No, but it was coming in over email, just one after another. And like, I guess some places are, and some managers, I think, are really creative sadists. Like, they're sadistic, but they're also like good at it, you know, and they can really know how to mess with people. And I didn't get into any of this in Lab Rats, but there's, you know, there's all that research or data about sociopaths being overweighted among CEOs and stuff. And you certainly get the sense, I actually think it's the middle management ranks, that there are middle managers, especially in startups where there's not a lot of oversight and not a lot of structure. So think of a place like Uber where they're growing really, really fast, right? And nobody has time to do anything. And HR won't help you. So as you know, with the Susan Fowler story, you could see that she was sexually harassed in horrific ways and there was just no recourse. But if you are a sociopath, like what better place would there be for you to than a place like that where you can get in and sort of this middle management level, you can really mess with people and just play sadistic games all the time with people just because that's what you get off on. And you can probably stay for a couple years, 3 years before you have to move on. And I think there are these people who bounce from company to company to company replaying these sicko scripts over and over. I also heard those kind of stories of people who had been following this one manager who left their company and went on again and again, and they kept hearing stories about him. It was like watching a serial killer move on to new cities, you know? And it's just, you start thinking, it's a really weird time right now to be in, and I'm sure office politics always existed too. So that's not entirely new that there are, you know, crazy sicko bosses. But the lack of oversight, I think, is maybe new, especially in the startup world. I think it's really the Wild West. And so that's different and new.
Absolutely. Lack of oversight and being so data driven, being so empowered by this technology on the back end that it allows for a number of things, which we're actually going to talk about here in a second. I need to take a quick break and thank the sponsor, but then we can talk about the four factors that contribute to worker unhappiness. There's a lot in here that people are going to recognize and, you know, possibly in their own situations. And thankfully at the end of your book, you kind of come around and reveal there is a light at the end of the tunnel, of course.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that in a second. Before we do, let's take a quick break and thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. That's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you are in the market for a house, you want to buy a home, you know that interest rates are rising. It can cause a little bit of anxiety. You don't know if now's the right time. It's a very unpredictable time when it comes time to buying a home. Do I wait? Do I jump? Like I said, a lot of anxiety being caused at this moment in time because of those rising interest rates and just not knowing what's going to happen. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about that that they call the power buying process. And it's really straightforward. Step one, you answer a few simple questions. They're going to check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Second step, Quicken Loans will verify your income, your assets, and your credit. It doesn't take long. It takes less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. And that gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And then step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval, which is really neat. First, they're going to lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. So whatever your rate was at that moment, it's locked in place. And here's the best part. If rates happen to go up during that 90 days, your rate is going to stay the same. It's not going to move at all. If the rates happen to go down, your rate will drop. So it'll move with it if it goes down. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking that you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. So to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of this show. All right, so we've got four wonderful, glorious factors that contribute to worker unhappiness. This is where we get really cheery.
Yeah, this is the happy part of the book. It's the slough of despond.
So money is the first one that you point out, and you know, there's a whole lot of factors. We don't have to go into obviously everything. That's why people need to pick up the book Lab Rats and read through it for themselves to kind of get the details. Income inequality seems like a really big component of this. I mean, and we see it all the time when we hear just about how these, you know, high powered CEOs, how much they're worth in comparison with the employees of their company, how that gap is widening so much, how the most important factor for a company is making money for its investors. And nowadays, it feels like things are a little different, right? It used to be that success was also balanced with the fact that a company could provide its workers a nice, you know, longevity, a feeling of security, all that stuff. But that's just not happening.
Yeah. So what happened is I ended up with this massive mountain of various things that make people unhappy, and I tried to boil it into four things just because it's easier to grasp that. And so there's money, insecurity or lack of job security, change, the idea that just we're faced with this constant change initiatives, and then dehumanization. And I think they're all important. Yeah, but to begin with money, yeah, there are two big factors. The income inequality you see just soaring in the last 10 years, and not just in Silicon Valley, but everywhere. But I think it is driven a lot by technology, and it's become a problem, a political problem, a social problem. It's a really, really potentially really bad force. I'm not saying this well, I'm sorry. But it's potentially really, really harmful to us in terms of our politics, in terms of the future of society, the fabric of society. Mm-hmm. And you have this new class of people now. They're referred to as the precariat, where they really have no steady, stable income, and they're financially are in a precarious situation. They live from month to month. So, say the gig economy worker is the best example of that. And essentially, technology starting in about the year 2000 enabled this massive wave of outsourcing in the United States. And then, as all those jobs got decimated, they were replaced with gigs that have no benefits, that have no security, no stability. Another incredible data point that I hadn't been aware of was just the amount of money that used to go to wages, the percent of GDP that went to wages has slowly and slowly and slowly shrunk, such that, simply put, I mean, just workers are getting less money now than they used to. That's we all kind of feel that way, but there's actually data that bears that out. And one estimate is that alone is the equivalent of $2 trillion a year, that if we went back to where we were, there would be $2 trillion more a year in wages going to workers in the United States. So it's a huge number that's been sucked out of the economy. So you look at that, so we're getting paid less, but at the same time, we have much more stressful jobs. We have no job security or much less job security, where we go to work and we're put into open offices instead of where we used to work. So there's change physically in where we work. There's change in how we work because we're agile, say. And then dehumanization is probably a book in and of itself. So essentially, we have worse conditions and you get paid less for it. So what also struck me as really significant about this is that when you go back to the late 90s and look at what people were predicting about the age of the internet, it was exactly the opposite of all this. So there was a great article by Kevin Kelly in Wired called The Roaring Aughts. No, The Roaring Zeros. And his prediction is, you know, the good news is you're going to be a millionaire soon. The bad news is that so will everyone else. And people were talking about this massive surplus of income we would have. We were going to have, just generate so much money. We would have lots of free time. So all the discussion was sort of very utopian. And then I almost feel like if we could take our 1999 selves and, you know, have a moment where you say, well, this is what it's really going to look like in 2018. We're going to have, you know, rising income inequality. We're going to have people blowing their brains out at work, or taxi drivers in New York blowing their brains out because the internet has destroyed the value of their taxi medallions, and you know, antidepressant use soaring, suicide rate soaring. You almost wouldn't have believed it. Oh, and Donald Trump is president, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the 1999 version of any of us just did not see any of this coming. And that's, to me, a fascinating thing. How did we get to that point where the internet's just about to take off in the year 2000, and then, wow, everything takes a 90-degree turn and goes, you know, off to the right instead of on the path we were on? That to me, is a really, really interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, at one point in the book, you mention Nick Hanauer saying things veer towards either a police state or an uprising as the gap between haves and have-nots widen. Do you, in some ways, that feels very, very apropos to right now in this moment in time. That seems very spot on.
Oh, no, yeah. And Hanauer, I think, is brilliant. Some people hate him. He was the first investor in Amazon. And he was already rich before that, but he made a fortune and then started looking at this income inequality gap and nerding out on Bureau of Labor Statistics data and, came to this realization. And then, politically, he says, you know, there's only two ways this ever ends in history. Either a violent uprising or a police state. And he wrote this great essay a couple years ago called Hey, Plutocrats, the pitchforks are coming for us. Like, he really thinks, you know, at some point people will be so angry and so disenfranchised that they will rise up. And I don't know if he thinks this, but it's certainly not it's a pretty common idea. I think it's true that disenfranchised precariat lashed out and elected Trump, thinking that we're angry, and this guy is telling us, you know, he's going to fight for us. And they know something bad has happened, but not really what, right? And how. And it's a very complicated subject to get your arms around anyway. And so Brexit's the same thing. You get this disenfranchised, angry populace, and they start lashing out and doing things like that that are actually, I think, ultimately, you know, counter to their wishes. They actually hurt those people even more. But you see that as almost the first step. If you look at Davos, the first January, right after the election in 2016, suddenly everybody wanted to talk about income inequalities. Everybody wanted to talk about alienation and disenfranchisement. Right before Davos in December, so the month after Trump was elected, but before he took office, I went to this really cool conference that's hosted every 6 months by people at the Yale Business School. And it's off the record. It's invitation only. And nobody there can write or talk about what they saw. And it's big CEOs, the former head of the CIA, you know, government ministers, billionaires, trade associations, some professors, some really big TV reporters that you would know. And I was way in the back, right? But all I could think is, you look around this room and everyone here is terrified, because I think they were all figuring that out. Like, oh my God, we've pushed things so far that, you know, people are rising up and they've just inflicted Trump on us. And Trump was already doing things like he had bashed Ford and crushed their stock, and then he bashed Boeing and crushed their stock. And people were, I mean, these guys who I think, they're mostly men, but were a very powerful figures and are accustomed to being sort of masters of the universe, suddenly felt they were no longer that. They were at the mercy of this mob, right? That Trump could whip up this mob against them. And it was all happening at a time when, even if that hadn't happened, we're, you know, beginning this this era that the World Economic Forum calls the Fourth Industrial Revolution, this period of massive disruption and change, and that's only going to accelerate with AI and robotics and automation coming into the picture. So, you know, what you really want is some kind of president or leader or world leaders who are, I don't know what kind of genius you'd have to be, but some kind of uniquely unique people in terms of temperament and intellect to handle this. I mean, you could look at the around the room, even these people who were very bright CEOs essentially didn't know where this is all going. Even the ones who were doing the disruption, like the tech CEOs, couldn't really give you a good answer. Like, well, don't worry, this all ends up like this. And then you add to that the it's compounded by this this chaos in the political spectrum and this idea of a mob, an angry mob. I mean, look at now where our Congress is essentially held hostage by this angry mob. Like, they're afraid to defy Trump because they'll get voted out of office by the mob, right? So in a way, what Hannah was talking about with the pitchforks is already happening. It's just not literally with pitchforks, but these people have kind of seized a lever of power and are using it in ways that are probably very damaging to society as a whole. So yeah, it's a Hanauer alone. It's just a fascinating guy, a really, really interesting guy to talk to.
Yeah, I imagine. Another part of these four, because we definitely don't have time to get into all of them, is the dehumanization chapter. Mm. What really spoke to me about this chapter was the idea that technology could have liberated us humans, but instead all it does is further control us, and you know that extends well beyond work. It's in our pockets, it's our smartphones that we are also carrying around with us and locked into on a daily basis. Is this such a large issue that it's hard to put that back in the bottle at this point? It feels so overblown at this point.
Yeah, and it's in big and small ways. There are various kinds of dehumanization you can look at, and some of them are as small as like, well, now we communicate with Slack instead of talking to each other, and that leads to some alienation. That's small, but interesting. But I hear even now over and over from people. I was on NPR a couple weeks ago, and we're on a show where people could call in, and there was a guy who called in. He runs a gardening company, but a big like commercial, gardening company. And he's like more or less describing that he works for a piece of software now, that he's managed, measured, monitored by software. Tonight I was at a friend's house when the UPS guy came, and we got talking about the stress of his job. And he's tracked constantly. He's basically working for a piece of software. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon in that, say 25 years ago, we had the sense that you had a PC and it had Lotus 1-2-3, and you used technology to do some task. People feel almost the opposite now, that you go into a workplace and technology uses you. And the company more or less says, geez, if we could do this all with machines, we would love that. Like, if Uber didn't have to have physical meat puppet drivers, if the cars could drive themselves, geez, that would be great. For now, we have to have you, but we want you to be as much like an autonomous vehicle, as much like a robot as you can possibly be. So do that. And Amazon warehouse workers are the same thing. Someday robots will do everything. For now, we still have to have you, but you can't take a bathroom break. We're not going to make you an employee. We're not going to pay you very well. We're not going to give you any health benefits. You'll be a contract worker. And pee in a bottle because you don't have time to take a break. Don't talk. Don't do this. Just work like a machine. And even at a much higher level, you have Ray Dalio, the guy who runs Bridgewater Capital,
right,
talking about his hedge fund. And his management style his advice to managers is, think of yourself as a machine within a machine. So you're a machine, and then you have six reports, and they're a machine, and you have to fit them into the bigger machine. So there is this sense that, it's sort of like the prevailing metaphor for our time is that the organization is a computer, is a machine. We are kind of the chips. That's why we get reprogrammed with Agile. The reason it doesn't work, however, is that we aren't as easy to reprogram as Agile. With chips, you could just send in the new Agile software and the process would change. Now, human beings don't do so well with that. But I think there was a time when the clock was the metaphor for what the human brain was or what the organization was, because clocks were like this new thing. So think of us as a clock. Now I think the overarching metaphor is that we are machines, we are computers inside a computer. And that of course, I mean, even just saying it as I say it, I mean, of course, it's very dehumanizing, right? It's by its nature, a dehumanizing idea. And I think that takes an enormous toll on people. There's a great anecdote in the book. And again, I don't mean great, like you're going to love this, but a terrible story of France Telecom years ago wanted to lay off a bunch of workers, mostly middle-aged men. And they were all specialized guys like satellite technicians or engineers. And they couldn't, because the company had once been, I think, a public company, I mean, a government-owned company, they were civil servants, so they couldn't be laid off. And so the company came up with this devious idea, well, just make them so miserable that they'll quit, which actually is fairly, that tactic is pretty common. It's happened to me, you know. And with the way they made them miserable and made them want to quit was they put them in call centers and made them read scripts, basically become robots, just people who had been used to some autonomy and some control and some power over their day-to-day life at work became machines. And if they were 2 minutes late in the morning, they got in trouble. They had to ask to go to the bathroom, and they had to sit with a headset on and just recite scripts over and over and over again. And unfortunately, what happened is instead of quitting, a bunch of them started killing themselves. And they had these waves of suicides at France Telecom, and they couldn't stop it. This was 10 years ago, but the people responsible, the CEO and others responsible, are now facing trial in France for their part in this. But you can see that, you know, dehumanizing someone really destroys them psychologically. And that is happening not for the same reason in companies now, but it's still happening. The same dynamic is happening. And so you can see where this doesn't lead to good outcomes.
No. Yeah. There's not a lot in this part of the book that does lead to very good outcomes.
Yeah. This sounds like a happy hell of a good read. You're going to get a great chuckle out of it. Everybody at home, I think, race out and get this one.
Promise we didn't make it to the third of the book that it actually offers some light, like Basecamp and Q. And you have a number of examples of companies that are doing things right, that are siding on the idea that as a company, you can make money, but you can also make the lives of the human beings that are behind the money that your company's making enjoyable and actually plentiful and still come out ahead. Maybe you aren't, you know, prioritizing profit over their lives as much as a lot of people in Silicon Valley and just publicly traded companies in general are, but there's still value there. There's still something to be said for that.
And these are what was fascinating to me is these are startups. These are startups run by young guys who, when you first look at them, you might think, oh, another tech bro. I mean, they look like, you know, tech bros. But so and not all, too. There's also a group called Zebras Unite where young founders are doing things. Yeah, so there's this amazing, cool stuff happening there. I would have been smarter with the book to call it a book about them and start with those inspirational stories and then say, now let's look at what they're fighting back against and step into the bad stuff and go back. Because I think maybe that's the next book. But there is this really inspirational movement, and it's growing out of tech. It's specifically emerging in Silicon Valley, I think only because Silicon Valley is the most extreme version of the bad kind of shareholder capitalism. So, yeah, it's and if you want to learn how to build that kind of company, you can study Basecamp, study Managed by Q, K4 Capital, Zebras Unite. You can look at these guys, and there's a roadmap there for how to do this. There's almost first principles that they all follow for building a healthy company.
And really, at the foundation of that, it's founders that have a responsible view on humanity. Really, well, at the end of the day, that's kind of what it's founded upon. Yes, you can have a successful company, but you also want to be good to your humans.
even below, be good to your humans. That's the name of that's a good book. Be good to your humans. No, I think also it's even a level below that. It's the money. It starts with the VCs.
That's true.
You hear founders say, "We'd love to do that, but we can't because our VCs won't let us." But maybe that's a cop-out too. But so there's also this movement to reinvent venture capital, to reinvest investing in a healthier way. So it's from the bottom to the top is the kind of change that's coming, I think. And I think we're seeing it this week with all the 20,000 Googlers walk out. Yep. And Google is, I think, probably the greatest place to work in the Valley, or was anyway. And we saw what happened at Uber. We see the backlash against Facebook and its business model of you know, gathering and exploiting your data. There is this real backlash, and people now are going, okay, that whole thing didn't work. What does? And maybe going back to some old virtues about investing in people, investing in human beings, maybe that does make sense after all. One data point I'll leave you with is try to think of the last company out of Silicon Valley that operates at scale and makes a profit. In other words, is successful, as I always define it. The last one is Facebook, which is 14 years old. They haven't had, and Silicon Valley used to produce that company all the time, that kind of company. All the time. You know, they'd grow fast, they'd turn a profit, they'd go public. Cisco was one. There's countless ones. That was why investors were drawn to tech in the first place, because they were making so much money and growing. And that has stopped, which tells me the business model, the VC model underneath it doesn't work. They're aiming for unicorns, not for building great, sustainable, profitable company. So that's really where the problem originates. It's with the money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So be good to your humans. I should point out the cover of Disrupted, your previous book, is a unicorn's head superimposed on a human's body. The cover of Lab Rats is a rat's head superimposed on a human's body. So,
and I got one more book to go on this contract.
Well, there you go. What do you plan to superimpose for the cover of your next book?
I don't know. I was thinking like a dog on a guy's head and call it Old Dogs. And it's about being older in the workforce. But that's, who's going to buy that? Because there's a real bummer of a book. You know what I mean? The next one, whatever it is, it's going to be fun. And like, I'm going to have it. Like, you can imagine, you know, writing this and doing all this research. It was just like, it's very depressing. Yeah. So, anyway, I'm looking for something funny, and it needs to be an animal. So if you have ideas, meaning you, Jason, or if people listening to this have an idea for like, here's the next book with a human-animal hybrid and a cool title, I will just hit me up on Twitter, send it along. I would that's what I'm looking for right now, because I want to make three books that work with animal covers. Yeah,
absolutely. All right. I had a feeling. At Real Dan Lyons on Twitter, right?
At Real Dan Lyons on Twitter. Yeah.
People can contact you.
I'm on there constantly trying to find out like what has Trump done in the last 5 minutes. Like I
don't do it. Just stay away. My life has improved so much when I turned off notifications from Twitter and just started focusing on my life. It's been great.
Seriously? Did you do that?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Jason Fried told me the same thing like a year and a half ago, the guy at Basecamp. Just stop all of this. Like, don't look.
Yeah.
And somehow I feel like if I don't, I don't know what's going to happen. Fear of missing out. It's like the world will blow up, and I think I'll know. If the world blows up, I will.
The really big stuff you find out. Yeah, you find out about the really, really big stuff. But following it on a hour-to-hour basis, which is what Twitter would love for you to do by feeding you notifications and you logging in 120 times, like, I don't miss it at all, man. I go in there and I send out my tweet, and then I go in there later and see if anybody replied to my tweet. And that's pretty much all I do with Twitter now.
I'm going to do that literally right now. That is a really good piece of advice. Just turn off all notifications on Twitter. Don't look.
At least then it's on your terms, right? That was kind of my point, is the reason I did it, because I felt like it was deciding what was important to me, not me deciding when it's important to me.
Ah, the technology is using you.
Yes.
Right? So, exactly. And it's that dopamine, and it's that little dopamine rush. But so you even turn off, so when you look at the icon, you don't see that it says 13 things pending or whatever. It just doesn't have a number. It's just nothing. You don't know.
If I launch Twitter, that's when it pulls me whatever the updates, the replies to my tweet was or whatever. So I might know that there are 9 replies. Great, I'll look at those and I'll reply to those people. But yeah, I don't go into the main feed anymore, and it's done wonders. I have to admit.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, man. That's the best advice I've had in a long, long time. I'm going to try that. But seriously, it is making me crazy.
Yeah. No.
And you can't work.
It's anxiety with no reason to be there. So. Dan, I'm happy to offer that to you, Dan.
That was awesome. Thank you. Yeah, it was great.
Dan Lyons, it's been a lot of fun talking with you, and I'm really happy that I had the chance to do this because I got to read the book and I got to talk to a really awesome human being. So Dan Lyons is the author of Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us. I promise, like, there's so many nuggets in here, and I promise the last third, it will put a smile on your face in comparison with everything else. Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on Triangulation.
Thanks for having me, Jason. It was nice talking to you. I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Best of luck. We do Triangulation every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. If you want to watch live, you can twit.tv/live, or you can go to our show page, and which is what most people do, and download it, subscribe to it. That's twit.tv/TRI for Triangulation. Go there. You're going to find all of our episodes, all of our interviews, and ways to subscribe to everything that we do. I do interviews, Megan Maroney, Leo Laporte. We all hop in here and get the chance to talk to awesome people like Dan Lyons. So we got a ton of interviews. Go catch up, and I guess, you know, check back next Friday for another episode. I'm Jason Howell. Appreciate you watching. We'll see you next week on Triangulation. Bye, everybody.